The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
S&P new high, and a lot of sectors in the S&P 500 new highs. Very euphoric mood on the street right now, and for, frankly, very good reason. It looks like the tax hike fears have diminished. We're not going to get a 28% tax situation for corporations. Maybe it'll be 24 or 25%, but it's not going to be 28. Manchin's against getting rid of the filibuster. So tax fears that have been around for months now are diminishing a little. There's obviously going to be something, but it's not going to be anywhere near the worst case scenario.
As more and more Americans are getting inoculated against COVID-19, the idea of so-called vaccine passports has emerged as a point of contention. Vaccine passports would be a form of ID to gain entry to certain businesses or cultural events that require patrons to be vaccinated. Proponents of vaccine passports say they could be key to reopening communities. Opponents, though, they raise constitutional and medical privacy issues. The discussion is already turning into a culture war.
The Biden administration is taking the wraps off of a $1.5 trillion budget request for the 2022 fiscal year that begins in October, the largest budget request in nearly two decades.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
The stock market is in record territory as Dow Jones Industrial Average starts heading towards 34,000. Who would have thought a couple of years ago we would be seeing a Dow or an S&P this high? Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplavin. Welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Joining me at the top of the hour will be Ralph Ancampora. Ralph is calling this a mega bull market. You're going to want to hear what this market sage has to say, what's ahead for the financial markets. Also later on in the program, Daniel DiMartino Booth joins me on the program from Quill Research as we take a look at the Fed minutes, the implications of MMT, and what this means for the economy and markets going forward. And then later on, Chris Sheridan and I will be here with the big picture. Today's topic, money for nothing. Checks are free as we talk about the stimulus programs, what it means for the economy and the stock market going forward. But first, let's find out what moved the markets this week with Ryan Poplava. Ryan?
Well, the most notable moves in the financial markets this week came on Monday. The strong reaction was a result of economic data released while the market was closed on Friday, with the jobs report in addition to the strong ISM non-manufacturing report on Monday. Combined, this led to a rise of about 1.4% for the S&P 500 and the Dow Jones Industrial Average up 1.1% to fresh record highs. The rest of the week was mainly a consolidation after this news, although we did eke out some new fresh highs in some of those areas as the catalysts thereafter were not as important and maybe as a result of buyer's fatigue? I don't know. There was a report from Bank of America on fund flows that showed the total global equity inflows in the past 5 months was $576 billion, which is well above the total inflow seen over the last 12 years of $425 billion. There's been some notable buying in treasuries this week, even with the stock market hitting highs, which could spell some defensive positioning. But underneath the surface, we continue to detect rebalancing towards the first quarter's laggards in growth and in the mega cap space, with the S&P tech sector up 4% on the week from the strongest areas of the quarter, like the energy sector, which is down approximately 4% for the week last I checked. There were significant announcements throughout the week, but they didn't move the needle that much. For example, the IMF raised its 2021 global economic growth forecast to 6% from 5.5% on Tuesday, didn't move stocks much at all, which closed mainly flat on the day. President Biden moved up the eligibility of adults for vaccines to April 19th, which didn't move things either. Despite the last time he did that, announcing the May 1st deadline, it did have an effect on stocks. And also on the pandemic front, the CDC said it will allow U.S. cruises to resume operations by midsummer with restrictions. Moving on, Jamie Dimon, CEO of JPMorgan Chase, an influential speaker, said in his annual shareholder letter, the economic boom could run into 2023, which also didn't move stocks much this week. He also said it's not unreasonable that there would be this increased inflation will not just be temporary. The FOMC minutes on Wednesday showed it will take significant time until progress is made towards its dual mandate. And at the same time, Dallas Fed President Kaplan, he's not a voter, won't be, I think, for a year or two, said the Fed can begin withdrawing emergency measures once the country has moved on from the pandemic. Chairman Powell also spoke on Thursday that the policy stance is still needed given the uneven and incomplete recovery currently. So again, very dovish Fed, supporting the market, but not really moving the market in a very big way. The producer price index climbed 1% in March, with the year-over-year increase at around 4.2%. Didn't move the stock market much on Friday. It did, however, in China. China reported similar hot numbers in March, with its producer prices showing 4.4% increases. Their stock market declined almost 1% on Friday. Also on the economic front, consumer credit expanded $27.6 billion in February. Now that's the largest increase since November of 2017. Again, that news alone itself also didn't move the market all too much, but is something to be considering. I've been following the retail sector and have noticed that we're starting to see some inflows into that area, maybe on news like this. Now, according to the Nikkei, Apple is postponing production of some MacBooks and iPads due to supply chain constraints. That news didn't move or hurt Apple, which largely brushed the news off. The stock was still up 1.9% on the day, on the sense that probably any lost sales could be made up later in the year with supply chain corrections. GM announced extended downtime last month to its plants due to semiconductor shortages, but it expects to recover in the second half. That's good news. As I mentioned last week, is that Taiwan Semi and Intel have announced big investments to increase production capacity. So, you know, with prices sky high, with production maybe increasing, investment increasing in the areas to help out on supply chain constraints, hopefully in the second half of the year, we won't have these huge issues we're seeing in producer price rising. But obviously, just like Jamie Dimon said, it might not prove temporary. So it'll be something that we'll definitely be watching. So to sum up the week, big push on Monday as a result of strong economic reports in the jobs data last week and the ISM non-manufacturing reading, and then a consolidation for the rest of the week with some rebalancing going on, definitely out of energy and into technology. We're coming up on the earnings season for the first quarter pretty soon here, and companies may not be able to get away so easily without providing guidance as conditions continue to improve as they have in the past. We'll definitely be wanting to hear from CEOs. Where do they think the rest of the year could go? The economy is opening up more. Vaccines are in place, but we still have some issues with supply constraints. PE multiples have expanded, largely on just price. Will CEOs raise guidance to justify the current prices? And even then, will it be enough to cause more flows into stocks? Or is it time to cool off and allow those multiples time for earnings to catch up? That's the biggest question on my mind this month. So look forward to my wrap-up report over the next few weeks to cover that topic at length. We'll be tracking how often these earnings reports talk about pipeline inflation and margin compression going from here.
Well-known chief investment strategist Ed Yardeni discussed his latest book, The Fed and the Great Virus Crisis, on FS Insider this week, looking at the three fronts being fought against what he refers to as World War V, the world war against the virus. Here's a clip of what he told listeners this week.
It's basically throwing money out the window at passersby and hope they pick it up and end the crisis. And that's exactly what modern monetary theory actually says. It says that it's okay for the government to spend as much as possible on a deficit financed basis to do whatever is necessary to make sure that everybody has a job, that all the infrastructure is brand new. And if inflation comes back, we just tax the areas where there's a problem. In other words, they say we could play whack-a-mole with inflation.
Given that the U.S. is now using modern monetary theory on steroids, Ed discusses the various outcomes he believes we'll see going forward and how the Fed is attempting to combat the five D's of deflation. If you want to hear this full interview with Ed Yardeni on FS Insider, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help.
from setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances in a zero-interest rate environment, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today at 888-486-3939. Let us work together to help you get on the path to success. Call now at 888-486-3939. Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow at financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, the stock market keeps hitting one record after another. If you think it can't go higher, it continues to do so. Let's find out where it's heading in the future. Joining me on the program is my good friend, Ralph Ancampora. Ralph, you and I were talking just before we went on the air about mega markets. I wonder if you would share with our listeners what you just shared with me.
Yeah, Jim, that's a term that I created about 21 years ago when I wrote a book called The Fourth Mega Market. And basically what I did, and you know, let me stop for a second. As a market analyst, and specifically a technical analyst, I'm a historian. And if you go back in history, you want to see if events have ever happened before. You know, history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. And in that book, I found out there were periods after wars where the market exploded. And it exploded because people were just so glad that the war was over. They suffered, so many people were lost, friends, relatives died in the battle. Sounds like COVID, doesn't it? We're in a war. We already lost over half a million people. Hey, that's more people we lost in the First World War. And after the Civil War, it was a period called the Gilded Age. The market went up about 275% in about 7 years. After the First World War, there was a thing called the Roaring Twenties. In fact, my good friend Ed Yardeni was on TV the other day talking about the Roaring Twenties. That was a 9-year period from 1921 to 1929, just before the crash. The Dow went up about 400%. That's when Henry Ford came out with the Model T and the Model T instead of the Model A, and people were buying new cars. And after the Second World War, it was called the Golden Age, and that was the 50s and 60s. The Dow went up another 13 years. By the way, it didn't go straight up. There were periods when it went flat, periods when maybe you had a pullback of 15 to 20%, but the lows were in. And the keynote to all of this is there's rotation. Notice what's keeping this market up is the rotation that we're getting almost every day. I was mentioning to you just before we did the call, look at Facebook. For a month or two, it was doing nothing. Everybody thought the move was over. Now it's making new highs again, all-time new highs. So I'm sorry to be so long-winded, but I really like what I see. And you know, from a technician's point of view, I'm almost biting my tongue saying this because every indicator, every momentum indicator you want to look at is just saying, hey, man, this market is too extended. It's too overbought. We got to have some kind of a pullback. I don't disagree with that. But I argue with anyone that thinks we're going down 20-25%. I don't see that.
Ralph, something else that we were talking about, and I know that your wife, Rosemary, was a big fan of this when she was working on Wall Street, which was dividend-paying stocks. And for the first time in almost, half a century, you've got to a point similar to where we were coming out of World War II, where stocks were the best place to go for yield as they are today. I mean, I can still get 3.5%, 4%, and maybe even 5% dividends in the market. I can't do that in the bond market.
No, exactly right. And that's a wonderful point you bring up, because that's another reason why money is gravitating towards the market. In fact, now that you mentioned that, you want to talk about a sector that's really underperformed the market, utilities. But technically, they look like they've bottomed and want to move higher. So And they, you know, and banks, the financials, I still like them a lot because they benefit from rising interest rates. And I really have to chuckle when I hear these young people talking about, oh, my God, the 10-year yield is almost 2%. And they're worried. I said, my heavens, my gosh, you don't have to worry about 1.5%, 2%, 2.5%, 3%. Historically, the market does fine. Where the red line is you cross for the stock market is if rates go above 5%, then the game is over for equities. But I don't think that's going to happen for a long, long time.
Even if you look at where yields are, there's some people saying once we get over 1.75% or 2%, we're in trouble. But Ralph, if I look at a graph of where yields were, let's say over the last 2 years, I mean, we were much higher this time last year before COVID broke out.
Of course. Of course. I think that the people who are making those statements have no sense of history. Just go back to the early 1970s. In the early 70s, that was the stagflation period when the Dow couldn't get above 1,000 for about 15 years. And rates went to 21, 22%, something like that. It was just insane. No, I'm not worried about rates. Not now.
Yeah, because if we take a look at where we've been over the last couple of years, it's hard to believe. But just 2 years ago, we were at a little over 3%, 3.25%. So it seems to me interest rates could have a lot more room to run before there would be any trouble for the market.
Absolutely. You know what I tell all the young people I see? Go out and buy a house and put it on a 30-year mortgage right now, because you'll never see in your lifetime, you'll never see rates like this. I bought an apartment in 1994, a wonderful penthouse apartment in New York City. And I kissed the banker because he only charged me 10.5% and not 12% for my mortgage.
Yeah, I remember the first mortgage Mary and I ever got. It was over 9%. When we moved to California, it was 12%. And I just had one of my employees last summer, Ralph, get a house with a 2.7% mortgage. I mean, below 3%. What's your feeling on the real estate market, like REITs in general, with rates as low as they are?
I think that's a group that'll come back, but I think it's the rotation. It'll participate.
So when you're speaking of rotation, what are you seeing on the rotation front? I know that like for part of last year, it was the FANG stocks. We called them the COVID stocks, your Pelotons, your Zooms. What about now?
Yeah, okay, good question. I mentioned utilities. Why don't I take a group that no one's talking about? It's telecommunications. I'm looking at the ETF right now. IYZ is the ETF. It hasn't been this high since, I think, 2017. From a technical point of view, it's been locked in a tight trading range for the last 4 or 5 years. So I think we're looking, or last 3 years, I should say. And now we're looking for, I think, all-time new highs at some point. So that's a group I would look at. Utilities I would look at. I'm talking about groups that haven't participated.
So what about those areas? You mentioned a couple areas that underperform. Utilities, energy was a big underperformer. Financials were a big underperformer last year. But a lot of that is changing. What's your take on energy here?
That's had been doing very, very well, as we all know. It's coming out of the most recent low was last October. I'm looking at it right now. And then in the last 2 weeks, it kind of backed off. I think energy is just consolidating. That's the rotation we're talking about. I don't see any major downside. I think if you're looking for an area that I think will resume to the upside, you know, maybe in a few weeks, I look at energy, XLE.
And then I want to come back to this concept about dividends and income, because stocks to me not only offer the highest yields out there, but Ralph, let's also talk about when you own individual stocks. Let's say you own a Coca-Cola, Procter & Gamble, Exxon, whatever it is, even though the market goes down as it did between 2007 and 2009, if you just sat and held your stocks, your income went up each year while the market was in a bear market. But then as soon as the market turned around, those were the first stocks to come back.
Yeah. Well, that's you were talking about my lovely wife, Rosemary. That's exactly what she did to our account. See, I could talk all day I want about the market, but she pulls the trigger when it comes to putting the money in the market.
How does that work? I mean, you know, you're a technician, one of the best out there. And when you see the markets breaking down, I love this story that you told several years ago about, 2007, you see the market breaking down. As a technician, you know what's ahead of you. So as a technician, you would kind of sidestep, let the market fall and get out and protect. But when you're in dividend paying stocks, you just hold on. Tell that story, because I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah, that actually happened to me personally, because I'm not going to say I knew it was going to happen per se, but I was really very, very concerned about the market. And I think I was on top of the market rolling over. And that's when everybody was starting to say, you know, what is this subprime? What? I was on TV with on CNBC one day. They said to me, why are you negative? I said, because of this thing called subprime. I don't know what it is. And then I said to him, I said, but more importantly, I don't think anybody else knows what it is. And that was so profound. And that's when it started falling apart. And then when I come home talking to Rosemary, I mean, we got out of a few things for sure. But the high yielding stuff, she said, no, leave it alone. Leave it alone. You got to get me out, and then you got to tie me back in. And she said, I'm going to be paying on my capital gains. And no, she went through a whole litany of reasons why longer term we shouldn't do that. And as you just said, for someone who's long term oriented, buy and hold high yielding stocks is the way to go. In fact, take advantage of a major decline and add to your position. And we're talking about quality names, of course. We're not talking about junk. But I went through that myself.
So given the years that you spent on Wall Street, if you were to distill it to one or two key lessons that you learned in your career about investing in the market, what would that be, Ralph?
I always tell people, and I have a big smile on my face, I'm half joking. They think I'm totally laughing. I said, be an optimist. And I really mean that. I mean, if you look at the long-term history of the market, if you bought in health over time, it did well. You know, I tell people who are not really, into the market, and they say, what do I do with some of my money? I said, just buy the S&P 500 and sit on it and don't do anything. You know, just buy the market and relax. So that's one thing I say to them. The biggest complaint the biggest problem people have told me they had, Ralph, I know exactly when to buy. I never know when to sell. So the timing of that is where, technicians come in. And I think with a little background, I would strongly urge people to, pick up a book, or maybe someday Jim will have a class on technical analysis. You can arrange it. I'll gladly teach it.
Oh, I would love that. Hey, whatever happened, you at one time, I know you were doing a lot of work with the New York Institute of Finance. Are you still doing that?
No, I haven't. Since I moved out here, I think they are doing it on their own. But there's an organization called the CMT Association. I helped start that. I co-founded that in 1970. It was called the Market Technicians Association. They have the certification exam, the Chartered Market Technician. That's what the CMT stands for. That's our version of the CFA. And if anyone's listening and really wants to pursue it, go online, CMT Association. There's a fellow by the name of Tyler Woods. You go ask about him and he'll plug you into the program. I think, again, if you want to be able to time your positions, when to get out, I think you should have a bit of a background in technical analysis. I've been doing this a long time. Jim, it amazes me. When I first came into business, a technician was looked at as voodoo. They said, oh, yeah, you're just playing with that paper and those lines. And, and they laughed at it. Now I listen to people on television and they're talking about moving average and Fibonacci Liberace numbers and all this sort of stuff. And I say to myself, does the viewing audience really know what they're talking about? No. The majority of people don't understand what a moving average is. They don't understand that. And they should, at least pick up a book. And I'm assuming these people on television, you know, did a little bit more than just read one book.
And so given what you see right now in similar periods, you think we're in one of those mega markets?
Yes, exactly right. Thanks for saying that. That sums it up very, very well. Yeah, I call it a mega market. Now, mega market means is a long-term rising market over time. It's not 6 months or a year. We're talking several years, maybe a decade. And I don't even want to go out that far, but several years, 3-4 years on top of what we have. Fine. And then, yes, you'll have periods of corrections, maybe even a bear market, you know, a pullback of 20%. It's not the end of the world. Yes, we'll have that. That I foresee. There's only one little fly in the ointment, and it could be a dinosaur someday, is that, you know, there's government spending all this money. And, you know, someday we have to pay for that. I don't even want to get into that. That's a couple of years down the road.
Okay. But right now, and by the way, the name of Ralph's book, it was called The Fourth Mega Market, worthwhile reading if you want to get a little understanding of where we are today. It's available on Kindle at Amazon. Well, listen, my friend, you stay safe. Say hello to your lovely wife and come back again. It's always a pleasure speaking with you.
Are you tired of earning a minimal interest rate on your investments? Are you looking for a higher rate of return on your money? Financial Sense Wealth Management has put together a portfolio of high dividend paying blue chips, high quality interest paying bonds, and preferred stocks. Our income account portfolio is specifically designed to help meet the needs of retirees, pension funds, and foundations looking to increase income and reduce taxes. To learn more, contact us at 888-486-3939 or email grow at financialsense.com.
Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, the Fed met recently and then notes are out. What will they be doing with interest rates as the budget deficits increase and commodity prices are rising? Does this mean inflation is on the horizon? Let's find out. Joining us from Quill Research is Danielle DiMartino Booth. Danielle, you read the Fed minutes. What did you come away with?
So to me, the Fed minutes scream of, we don't care what the market tries to strong arm us into doing, we're going to stand pat and we're not going to tighten interest rates in response to what we are convinced will be transitory inflation. Jim, let me just take you back to 2011 when we had CPI print at 3%. That was a big number back then. And there was a lot of scare about inflation coming back. By the time I got to 2015, the CPI was cut in half. And 2 years from then, the CPI was cut in half again to 0.7%. And I have a very contrarian view on commodities, because I think that China has been very strategic and shrewd in making sure that there was this massive amount of demand for commodities that ran prices up. And now they're in a position, if you will, because so many American manufacturers are getting squeezed to death with high input costs. And it doesn't matter that it's an inflation scare as opposed to ingrained inflation. That doesn't matter if your profits matter. And that's the bottom line. And right now your margins are really hurting. But there is an opportunity for China to step in. Many U.S. manufacturers, because of the supply chain disruption and rising input costs, have had to turn to higher cost U.S. suppliers. And so to me, at least, this is a strategically opportune moment for China to come back while the rest of the world is focused on other China-United States relations. But this is a great opportunity for Chinese manufacturers and suppliers. Remember, China is the biggest steel producer in the world by a factor of 10 times larger than India. But this is a great opportunity for them to come in and sell products into the U.S. supply chain and regain lost market share that they lost post-pandemic. And if you'll notice, Copper prices have begun to fall. Why? Oh, because demand in China isn't what it was supposed to be. So to me, there is a lot of strategizing going on the part of the Chinese. And I am no conspiracy theorist, Jim. I just think that a lot of this is planned, shall we say.
So if we take a look at what we're doing now, we're seeing the largest infusion of fiscal stimulus, at least in my lifetime. And I wonder if you might contrast, Danielle, this compared to, let's say, when we came out of the financial crisis, the Fed was printing money, but a lot of that money stayed on the balance sheet of the Fed. It never worked its way into the economy in the form of credit. Contrast that to what's going on today, and what are the implications?
So these have major implications, not because of what a momentary shot of stimulus is going to do, but more so, Jim, because it's already planted in the minds of millions of Americans that this is a better way of life, that they're better off to get paid to not work. And I mean, I'm not even making this up. If you add up what a single working mother with two children, one under the age of seven, one between the age of 7 and 18, with the increased child care tax credit, with the rental eviction moratorium, with the Obamacare premium covered, with the extra $300 a week of unemployment benefits, with the average of $400 a week or so nationwide of regular state unemployment, add it all up, you get to $60,912 income. So why work? It's not that the $1,400 is going to move the needle. It's going to create a burst of services inflation. And it's going to make, I was in Orlando for the long Easter weekend with my family. Let me tell you, America's spending those stimulus checks and they're spending them quickly. But we anticipate also that a good chunk of that stimulus money is going to go to pay down debt, and a good bit of it went into the stock market. So it's not the inflation that is momentary and transitory, and I almost never agree with the Fed, but it's not that services inflation that we're seeing. It's not blowout car sales because people decided to run out and get a new truck because they had this, you know, I think the average US household got somewhere around $4,000 in stimulus money. So they had that massive down payment that they could go make on that new F-150. That's not what I'm worried about. I'm worried about the ingrained sense of entitlement for those being paid to not work and demanding going forward this level of welfare. I'm just going to use the word that it is, be continued.
And what problem does this create on the labor? Because a lot of the financial channels have been running stories of restaurant owners, gym people, service people trying to recruit, and they can't get anybody. And one restaurant owner said, why should somebody come and work for me when they can make more not working?
And that is, I read an article yesterday that there was a pool bar at a small hotel somewhere in the South that literally could not get enough employees to reopen that portion of the hotel. And you cannot drive. Warren Buffett used to say, I can't buy a stock unless I can go kick the tires, unless I can go and see tangibly what it is that, what the company is that I'm buying. And by that same token, if you need to know about the labor shortage and about the damage being done to small businesses, they've already had a lot of damage done to them, by the way. But the extra damage being done, drive around, kick the tires, look at the help wanted signs, they're everywhere. And that's just wrong. It's wrong on so many levels. I mean, I worked at a pizzeria when I was 15 years old. That was my first minimum wage paying job. And it taught me a good lesson. You don't want to work for the minimum wage, but it was still a starter job. And those positions still need to be filled. And that's why there are ladders in the career, in everyone's careers, but you start off somewhere and those positions need to be filled. And you're going to have companies that cannot pay up to get employees and simply will say, I can't make the math work, and not open. And what a big backfire that is.
Now, what about, okay, so we have a situation where you can make more money not working, and they look like they're going to continue that. They've hinted when the benefits run out September, they may extend it. What also about the new coming tax increases? What's your view on that? Will that stifle the economy, or will we simply just get past it?
You know, you don't get past tax increases. And it's really interesting to hear the propaganda. Again, sorry, welfare fit the bill. It's propaganda to say that U.S. companies are going to, for the greater good, pay their fair share. That's not how it works. That's why they have armies of CPAs. That's why they have treasurers. And who loses? The employees, because they're going to cut costs to offset higher taxes. It is what it is. And those cost cuts will come in the form of positions that are not filled. So who do the tax hikes hurt the most? The people who can afford it the least. And, you know, there are certain things that we call empirical evidence. And I wish that politicians could see past their noses and understand that there are unintended consequences, and there will be no 140 countries worldwide who agree to have a higher tax rate. I mean, think about Ireland and its role that it's played as a virtual magnet to other countries around the world, because it's got a low cost tax regime. So Janet Yellen's idea that she's going to get all these countries to agree to pay, to charge higher corporate taxes, and so that everybody can be less competitive, it's a non-starter.
It reminds me of Danielle, of the number of states in this country, Florida, Texas, Nevada, that has zero taxes, that are getting this influx of Californians, New Yorkers that are helping the state economy. Why would Nevada, Texas, or Florida want to raise income taxes and spoil the benefits of what they're realizing with people moving in? I guess it would be the same for countries. If I was Ireland, why would I want to raise my taxes to become less competitive?
That's exactly right. And that is why states like Texas, that is why states like Florida, Nevada, that's why they are the economic beneficiaries of other states' high tax levels. It's as simple as that. If right now we're looking at the city of New York possibly raising taxes to the extent that it's more expensive tax-wise than San Francisco, which is, I think, the current most expensive city in the country to live in. You cannot tell me that this is going to cause countless wealthy New Yorkers, they'll just get up and leave.
And, you know, that's interesting. I was wondering if some of the governors start using things like vaccine passports to limit, let's say, immigration into their state, because I saw what New York's doing. They're raising their tax rates that'll actually be higher than my own state of California, raising the estate tax. And I believe, Danielle, they have another tax if you have a second home or your home is north of $1 million, a special assessment. And then they wonder why people are leaving.
Yeah, there's no mystery here. There's no mystery at all. And you will see it in, again, the states that benefit. There is a downside to this. It is not as the city of Austin, Texas, I think home prices are rising at a clip that's close to 30%. So when you have all of this out migration and people who are, relatively speaking, compared to the natives of the state, price agnostic, you've got somebody from California who sold their home. They land in Dallas, Texas, and they're like, look, the homes are on sale. It's like buy one, get one free. But that ends up pricing a lot of people out of the state. There are people in Boise, Idaho right now, which is the nation's hottest housing market for in terms of where people are moving to. But you've got local people in Idaho who are like, I can't afford to live in my own home anymore, in my own home state, in my own home city. So again, the governors of some of these states have no idea of not just the damage that they're doing to their own states, but ultimately the damage that they do to other states. And God help us if, no offense to Californians, but God help us if they start to vote in some of the policies and taxes that caused them to leave in the first place in their new home states.
Well, it's definitely changed the influx of voters into Arizona, has turned it from, let's say, red to blue. And, you know, it's interesting. You mentioned a story. We were looking in Reno about 2 years ago, and the real estate people were telling me, the Californians from San Francisco, you come into Reno and it looks like it's a bargain sale on housing compared to San Francisco, but it was pushing people out of Reno to go to Idaho because it was cheaper.
And that's the thing. You'll have this constant flight and people looking for, you know, a cheaper way to live. I have two high school students who attend boarding school in Indiana. We were looking to buy us a home there because at some point we'll have three of our four kids there, and I'll be spending more time there than I am in Dallas. But the influx of humanity from the state of Illinois, escaping those taxes, escaping those massively underfunded pensions, has made it literally impossible to buy a home in Indiana. So there are no clear-cut winners right now. And what people don't understand, what politicians don't understand, again, getting back to what we were talking about earlier, is that when you pay people to not work, you also don't have the corrections in markets that are necessary from time to time. You're paying all these people money and making sure that they can't be foreclosed on in a home that they can't afford to be in. Well, that just makes home prices for everybody that much more expensive if you have a recession, but you don't have a household credit cycle come out of it. And that's, I think, one of the reasons we're seeing subprime car loan delinquencies go through the roof. It's one of the few places where we're seeing truth. It's that the car financing companies finally pulled the plug and said, okay, it's time to pay up. It's been a year now. And so but you're not seeing that in housing. You're not seeing that in apartments.
Danielle, how long before this issue? I was reading the same thing the Wall Street Journal did a story on, that there hasn't been that many foreclosures on real estate and other types of credit because we have all this forbearance. But can they keep forbearance going forever? At some point, doesn't this have to come home to roost where, you know, banks or let's say investors that are renting out that aren't getting rent? I have a friend that has quite a few rentals and he's had to deal with forbearance. When does it stop and the reality set in?
Well, I think it stops. And this is, it's just, I can't believe we're already talking about elections, but I think it stops with the midterms. But I'm not even positive about that, because Trump showed us that an executive order was able to extend the rental eviction moratorium. But you would think that it would stop with a change in the House and the Senate in the midterms, mainly because one party is pushing through massive amounts of stimulus spending straight down party lines. And there's nothing that benefits a country that's already divided by legislating in that manner. I mean, there are great examples in U.S. history of presidents who were able, and Congresses, who were able to find a bipartisan path. And if everything's going to be done strictly down party lines, then every 2 years or so, you're going to have a massive change. And that's really no way to legislate either.
No, we're seeing it just from a planning perspective. It used to be the tax laws were fairly constant, you know, beginning with Clinton raised them, but they stayed there for quite some time. But now, Danielle, it seems like every administration comes in. Okay, so Bush comes in, he lowers taxes. Obama comes in, he raises taxes. Trump comes in, he lowers taxes. Biden comes in, he raises taxes. So it seems like, you know, it makes it harder, I guess my point, for business or even individuals to plan. You know, how do you plan for estate planning when every couple of years they're changing the tax laws?
That's exactly right. I mean, as my mother once said to me, I want you to get your CPA and then become a tax attorney. She's like, you'll have income for the best job security in the world. Trust me, daughter, go there. Because the only ones who win are the estate attorneys, the tax attorneys, the CPAs, because the tax code just keeps getting. And the problem is, even with the changes that are going on, you still end up with the tax code getting thicker and thicker and thicker. It's just, it's almost impossible to navigate. And who wins in these kind of environments? You're right. It's absolutely impossible to plan.
So given this, the fact that we've got massive, and I'm talking about massive amounts of stimulus coming into the economy, as an investor, do you just stay invested and ride the wave?
Well, you know, that's a good question. When you've got stock valuations in their 99th percentile in history back to the 1800s, that's a really hard question to answer. It's an exceedingly difficult environment to be an investor, because right now we are, everything is based on confidence that the Fed's policies are going to continue to be able to prop up bonds and stocks.
At some point, they come home to roost. Well, listen, Danielle, as we close, you have a fascinating newsletter, a lot of great stuff in it. If our listeners would like to find out more about it, tell them how they could do so.
So please come to quillintelligence.com. I would love to have you as a subscriber. And if you don't follow me on Twitter, I'm proud to say that some people say that the education they get on my Twitter feed is better than what they got in college in their economics classes. So also follow me on Twitter at DeMartino Booth.
Danielle, thank you so much. Stay safe and come back again.
This week, we picked up with part two of our interview with Camilo Russo, founder of The Defiant, author of The Infinite Machine, how an army of crypto hackers is building the next internet with Ethereum. Here's a clip of what Camilo had to say when it came to the topic of whether Ethereum could surpass Bitcoin as the world's most valuable cryptocurrency.
Ether is not necessarily the store of value, but Ether is the currency that you use to pay for transactions on top of what will be the base layer of the entire financial system. So I do think that longer-term vision has the potential to be bigger than Bitcoin.
To hear this full interview where Camilo discusses how Ethereum has a larger array of use cases and applications over Bitcoin, the difference between the number of coins that can be mined for each, and how non-fungible tokens are part of a larger trend toward the exchange of value and the holding of digital property rights in virtual space, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button. Welcome, everyone, to this week's Big Picture. The title of today's show is Money for Nothing, Checks for Free. And that's a play on the Dire Straits song called Money for Nothing, which many of you have probably heard. And as we mentioned in one of our prior Big Pictures, one of our favorite quotes is from Genzo Parsons, a man that we had the pleasure of speaking with on our show in the past. He says, "Everyone loves an early inflation. The effects of the beginning of inflation are all good. There's steep in money expansion, rising government spending, increased government budget deficits, booming stock markets, and general prosperity, all in the midst of temporarily stable prices. Everyone benefits and no one pays. That is the early part of the cycle."
What we're seeing now is something we did not see coming out of the financial crisis or even the bursting of the tech bubble. The Fed lowered interest rates, and coming out of the financial crisis, the Fed printed a lot of money, but most of that money stayed on the balance sheet of the Fed. It did not get into the economy. And so this time around with MMT, we are fusing monetary policy with fiscal policy. So we're getting into helicopter drops. So, you know, you take a look at these checks, stimulus checks, supplemental unemployment checks. They're expanding the earned income credit, special loans and reparation checks in a lot of these programs, for example, the $1.9 trillion. So if you look at this, what we're really doing is monetary policy is shown to be less effective. So what the government is trying to do here with these helicopter drops, they don't want the money remaining on the Fed's balance sheet or going into, let's say, just the financial markets. They want to get it into the economy. So the way they're doing that is these direct checks. So if you take a look at how this works, the government sends you a check, the Treasury issues a bond to pay for it, and then the Fed goes in and buys that bond. So basically, we're talking about free money. Those checks are free, hence the name of today's program. And the idea, it looks like this is going to be something that we're going to see, just as we saw, for example, coming out of the financial crisis, we saw QE1, QE2, QE3, QE4, QE infinity until we didn't need it anymore. We're doing the same thing with stimulus. We passed $1.9 trillion. Now they're talking about $2.3 trillion for infrastructure. And then they're also talking about what they call another $2 trillion for human infrastructure, basically getting more checks to people. So, and then we also have an issue coming up September 6th, the extended unemployment benefits from the federal government that they're giving money in addition to the unemployment claims that you're receiving, that will end September 6th. They're talking about renewing that. So, Chris, this is going to be just as we saw multiple QEs, it's going to be multiple stimulus. And this is going to be, I mean, if you just take a look at, let's just go back to December. Okay, so we had a stimulus bill with Trump. That was $900 billion. Biden just passed a $1.9 trillion. They're working on an infrastructure bill of $2.3 trillion. Then a human infrastructure bill, or let's call that infrastructure two. So we're looking at now constant stimulus checks. Now, why this is important, let's put this in perspective. The government, and this began with Obama, then it went to Trump. The first time we saw trillion-dollar deficits was coming out of the financial crisis under Obama. We had, I think, 4 years of trillion-dollar deficits. And then, even though the economy was expanding under Trump, the budget deficit, I think, in 2019 was $1.3 trillion. And, of course, last year with the stimulus spending that we did, the budget deficit came in at $3.1 trillion. The Congressional Budget Office is now talking about the deficit will be running 16% of GDP or more for the balance of this decade. So you have a regular deficit somewhere, let's just round it off for math, $1 trillion every year. Then on top of that, $1 trillion of just running the government, that's, you know, programs for Social Security, Medicare, interest on the debt. Now we're adding these supplemental spending programs, the Trump stimulus of $900 billion, the Biden stimulus of $1.9 trillion, then the infrastructure, then infrastructure two. So that's why they're saying that the budget deficit this year could be $4 to $5 trillion. So, Chris, if we keep going at this rate, we are going to be at $40 trillion, if not $50 trillion, by the end of the Biden administration's first year in office. So deficits are accelerating at this point because there is a change in philosophy in Washington that if you want to get economic growth, it has to be driven by government spending. And that's exactly what we're seeing. As Ed Yardini said, you know, we're seeing it basically on steroids.
Yeah, it was a very interesting interview this week on Insider with Ed Yardini on his new book, The Fed and the Great Virus Crisis. And as you pointed out, I mean, at this point now, he calls the U.S. government, or at least he calls the fiscal and monetary authorities the T-Fed. So it's no longer just the Fed, it's the Treasury Fed. They're united at the hip. And Powell made a pivot towards modern monetary theory, he says, in March of last year with the COVID crash. And now at this point going forward, the Fed is doing all that it can to monetize U.S. government debt to help the U.S. government spend as much as it needs in order to help the economy get back to the levels that it wants. So it doesn't look like we're going to be making a U-turn on the type of policies that we see currently anytime soon. So Jim, as a result of all of this stimulus that's being thrown at the markets and the economy and more likely to come, what does this mean for economic growth this year?
Well, if you take a look at the economic forecast, we're seeing growth rates this year that, Chris, we probably haven't seen since you would probably have to go back to maybe the 90s during the tech boom, or maybe even the 60s, because the economic growth. Now, remember, we're spending a lot of money, but it's not just us. It's global. Stimulus spending from governments in the G20 is estimated to be over $12 trillion. So if you look at J.P. Morgan's Jamie Dimon came out yesterday, he's very bullish and optimistic on the economy. He sees 6% plus economic growth. If you look at what the IMF is saying, the IMF is saying that economic growth in the United States could reach between 6 and 8% this year. So let's talk about the two biggest economies in the globe, China and the U.S. Between the two countries, we represent 40% of global GDP. So the U.S. is expected to drive this with 6-8% economic growth. And in China, they just upgraded China's economic growth to 8.4%. So I don't care where you're looking. If you're looking at emerging markets, 5% economic growth. Latin America, 5% economic growth. The slowest growth will probably be in Europe, but that could be 2-3%. So when you throw all this money at the economy, which is a sharp contrast now, because as we mentioned, you have the Treasury merging with the Fed. The Fed is basically monetizing the debt that is being issued by government to pay for all these stimulus packages. And so when you throw that, you know, let's just kind of add this up. Trump's bill, let's round that off to $1 trillion. Biden's first COVID stimulus, round that off to $2 trillion. So now we're at $3 trillion. The infrastructure bill they're talking about is $2.3 trillion. So that is $5.3 trillion. Then infrastructure two, another $2 trillion, that is $7.3 trillion. And then another maybe trillion coming out in September to complete the year. So we're basically, you know, let's just say that U.S. GDP is right around $21 trillion. We're going to inject $8 trillion into the economy. So no wonder we're going to see growth rates. And some of this can carry over into next year because, Chris, stimulus spending is now the norm embraced by both parties in Washington and both by the Treasury and the Fed. So we're now in that sort of good part of inflation where you have faster economic growth, rising markets, rising deficits. And right now, there aren't any consequences. And that's what the MMT people will tell you about. Hey, as long as you're issuing debt in your own currency, don't worry about it.
Yeah, and all this stimulus, too, acts with a lag, right? It's not immediate. So when we see these trillions of dollars that you're talking about that are being spent by the government into the economy and the markets through either interest rates or through just money printing, it's not immediate in terms of the effects of how we see it impact the economy. These things can last quarters, if not up to years. So like you said, we could see this play out into at least till next year.
At least into next year, and we'll talk about what would be a signal that this is going to come to end. Because when you're spending at this kind of level, and we'll get into the side effects of this, is you have an inordinate amount of leverage that's in the financial system right now. It's one of the reasons the Fed moved expeditiously when COVID first surfaced. They started to intervene not just in the Treasury market, they intervened in the corporate bond market and the municipal bond market because about 50% of all corporate debt is basically BBB rated. In other words, one notch down, and that would be junk bonds. And a lot of these funds and ETFs would have had to dump their corporate bonds, leading to a credit crisis. So now you've got a large amount of leverage that's in the financial system, that's in the economy. I don't care if you're looking at corporate debt, individual debt, or government debt. And so, but right now, we're going through that good part.
Well, Jim, what does this mean for investors?
Well, as Ralph talked about earlier in the program, we're in a mega bull market. You cannot spend this kind of money with stimulus and then monetary stimulus on top of that without it going somewhere. And as we have talked about in past programs, money has three places it can go. It can stay in cash or in a mattress. It can go into the economy, which is inflationary, or it can go into assets, creating asset inflation. In the last decade, the monetary stimulus that was put into the economy mainly took place in the financial markets, where we had almost a 300% plus gain in the markets over the last decade. So if we look at what's happening now, you have a large inflow of money into the markets. You know, this is something that John Kosar mentioned, that he tracks money flows into ETFs, kind of give them a feel, where's money going? And also, it just reported yesterday, FINRA announced that margin debt in the markets is the largest it's ever been. It's currently around $814 billion. as of February, and that I'm sure that number's gone up for the month of March. So individual investors are not only just putting their money in the market, but they're also borrowing. And under margin requirements, you have to post margin of about 50%. So if you wanted to buy, let's say, $100,000 worth of stock because you think the market's going to go up, you only have to post $50,000 a margin, and the other $50,000 to buy those stocks, you borrow. So investors are so bullish that margin debt is at a record level. And that's why Ralph was talking about this mega bull market. The other thing that's happening is if you're in bonds this year, you probably lost 15 to 20%. Because remember, last August, we were down below 0.5% on 10-year treasuries. Today's 10-year treasuries are over 1.7%. So, you know, ETFs like TLT, LQD, a lot of these bond ETFs have lost a lot of money. So when you're inflating and stimulating, as we are doing now, and you are putting in faster economic growth, if we hit, let's say, 6 or 7%, bonds are out of favor. They're not working that 60-40 split that everybody talks about that's been in place for, let's say, half a decade or half a century, 60% stocks, 40% bonds. It isn't working. Your bond portfolio is delivering losses. So stocks over bonds, we're also seeing commodities jump. And we'll get into commodities here as we talk about inflation. The other thing is Ralph was talking about bull markets continue, and part of that continuation is rotation. So last year, the markets were driven by the FANG stocks, the COVID stocks, your Pelotons, your Zooms, your Microsoft, Apple, those kind of stocks. Now it's kind of rotating into cyclical areas of the market, industrials, financials, and value versus growth. And so, like I said, we began this, we're in the good part of inflation. And so no matter what you think about the deficits, no matter what you think about politics, the fact is a large amount of money is going into this market as well as the economy. And that means bigger market prices, more records coming ahead.
When we think about this mega bull market that we're in right now, what are some of the risks? I mean, nothing just goes straight up, right? So we are going to see pullbacks. We are going to see some trouble in the economy. So what are some of the risks that you're focused on currently?
You know, it's amazing. We're following a parallel historical pattern that we saw in the latter 60s and the 70s. The Fed at that time under Arthur Burns was inflating the economy. That continued until we got Paul Volcker. But basically, the two big risks here is what, you know, I got in this business probably around 1980. The two big things the markets were focused on were taxes and inflation. And those are going to be the two risks to this market and this economy going forward are taxes and inflation. Let's begin with inflation. We're already seeing, for example, we just got producer prices inflation for the month of March. It was up 1% annualized year over year. It's up 3.1%. The Wall Street Journal put out an article this week, along with the Financial Times, that China, which was an engine for deflation because they could produce goods cheaper, and that kind of manifested itself as they pushed goods across the globe as China became the manufacturing capital of the world. But China is now raising prices for two reasons: increase raw material cost and increase transportation costs. So instead of being an engine of disinflation, China is now becoming an engine of inflation because we import. I mean, take a look at the goods that you buy in the store. I don't care if it's industrial goods, gym equipment, or anything else. It's made in China. Commodity prices. I did a check on commodity prices, and year over year, this is the last 12 months, we have raw material prices that are being built. You're seeing this in the ISM, prices paid components. The CRB index is up 44% year over year. Copper is up 82%. Lumber up 214%. Ag ETF up 23%, silver up 60%, platinum up 62%, WTI 148%, corn 67%. And remember, corn is used as an additive in so many foods, soft drinks. So we're seeing it come in. I had a client, we were talking about food inflation because they noticed that going to the store, I don't care if you're buying beef, chicken, fish. I mean, I bought salmon last week and it was like $48 a pound. And anyway, my client was saying that coming out of the grocery store, noticed that a lady was looking over her receipt on her groceries and they just started a conversation. She said, I can't believe what I just paid for what I just bought. So if you look at also, besides the stimulus, besides the things that we're doing, the lockdown cut down on supply, it affected the supply chain. At the same time that we were reducing the supply of goods and services, we were increasing the ability to buy those goods and services with the checks or the helicopter drops that we're sending. But on a bigger picture, let's talk about a macro drop that is going to change the inflation picture. One of the reasons we didn't get inflation with all the deficit spending, money printing over the last three or four decades, it goes back to the 70s. Women entered the workforce, so you now had additional labor pool coming in, which helped to reduce costs. You also had the opening up of emerging markets, where companies began to transfer manufacturing or building plants overseas, where the labor costs were cheaper, which came with globalization. So you had an expanding labor pool, you had globalization, and you had technology. Now fast forward to where we are today. You have aging populations in Asia, China, Europe, even here in the U.S., we look the best. So you have a shrinking labor pool. You also have this movement of reverse globalization, which began with tariffs under Trump. And then you have something that we talked about, the land of the giants. You have an increasing monopolization of companies. You're seeing it in every single sector, mergers. So basically, you're seeing it in social media. You have some upstart company that comes up with the new technology. You just buy them out. So companies are getting bigger, which goes in hand with big government. But oligopolies control pricing. That means higher prices. I've even noticed, maybe you have noticed this yourself, go to Amazon. Amazon is no longer the cheapest place to buy something. There are other online sites that you can go and get goods cheaper. And the real key thing here you got to think about is, as I reported, producer prices are up, consumer prices are up, and the Fed, as you mentioned, Chris, is adopting MMT. It says, we are willing to tolerate higher rates of inflation. In other words, let the economy run hot for a while to make up for the disinflationary period of the last decade where the Fed never achieved its 2% inflation target. However, I would argue a lot of the inflation figures that we report to consumers are sort of constructed in a way that it doesn't reflect the full price of inflation. I mean, just look at what you're paying for gas, your property taxes, your utilities, your phone bills, food, medical bills, medical premiums. It's probably going up faster than that, but the reported inflation was less than 2%. Right now, the Fed is saying, we're okay if inflation starts to heat up.
Yeah, and that's the thing is that the Billion Prices Project, which was started by MIT tracking billions of different prices for various goods all across the U.S., and they also do so for various countries around the world, they have shown that inflation is underreported right now, especially in light of the fact that we've seen consumer purchasing behavior dramatically shift in light of COVID. A lot of that's not being picked up by the official figures right now. And so there is an underreporting, at least according to their data. And I think anecdotally, we all feel that and know that to be true. As we discussed with Ed Yardeni this week, and as we mentioned on our show as well here on The Big Picture, according to modern monetary theory, hey, it's okay if you print these trillions of dollars and issue checks to individuals, run these large budget deficits, because if inflation comes up, all you got to do is just tax people to cramp down on inflation, right?
Yeah, what we don't know, we know that when Obama increased taxes in 2012, it slowed economic growth. What we don't know right now is the outcome of how this tax bill is going to be proposed. One of the Democrats, Senator Manchin, is indicating that he's against some of these corporate tax increases. Now, what they're proposing is an increase in corporate taxes from 21 to 28%. Obviously, that's going to have an impact on corporate earnings. However, it's going to put the U.S. at a disadvantage because, once again, we'll go right up to the top of the list, is one of the highest corporate tax rates in the G20. So what Yellen is doing is saying, you know, this is not going to work. If we raise our tax rates to 28% and tax rates are lower overseas, you could start seeing inversions again. And if you're not familiar with an inversion, let's say I'm a U.S. company. What I do is buy another company that is domiciled in a low tax jurisdiction, let's say Ireland. I buy that company and then I move my headquarters from the U.S. to Ireland. So what Yellen is saying, for this to work, we've got to get the G20 all agree on a minimum tax, which she's proposing, of 21% on international income. So Biden is proposing two tax increases, raising the corporate tax rate from 21 to 28, and then overseas tax rates from 10 to 21. So Yellen is calling for a global minimum tax. Chris, I don't think it's going to happen, because if you were a low tax country, or, you know, let's just bring this down to the United States. Let's say you're Texas, Florida, or Nevada. You have zero income tax rates. Why would you raise, like, let's say the government came out and said, we want all states to have the same tax rates of New York or California. Would you do that? I don't think so. So we don't know how this is going to play out. The second thing that we don't know, and it's not clarified yet, is if we revert back to the Obama-Biden tax rates that were put into effect in 2012, then all the income under $100,000 is going to be taxed at higher brackets. So for right now, for example, if we look at tax rates, in a married couple would not pay any taxes on the first $19,800 of income. There's a zero tax. If you're single, round it off to 10. Well, if we go back to the tax rates that were in effect prior to the tax cuts put in place by Trump, you would have 10% tax on that $19,000. Then instead of going from a 10% bracket to, let's say, a 12% bracket, it would go from 10 to 15, then would go from 15 to 25, then to 28 and 33. So the brackets at the lower level go up. So the middle class taxes could go up unless they keep the Trump tax rates for, let's say, the first couple $100,000 of income, and anything over that, they go to the higher tax rates. Right now, the highest tax rate is 37. It would go to 39.6. Add the Medicare tax of 3.8% or Obama tax, you're roughly at about 44%. Now, here's the thing that we pointed out last week, or the last time, is it doesn't matter what the tax rates are. They could raise taxes to 90%. The government never takes in more than 17 to 19% of GDP. It's been that way going all the way back to 1913, and we have a graph of that from the St. Louis Fed that you could see on the show that we did a couple weeks ago.
Well, Jim, as I read at the beginning of today's show with the quote from Genzo Parsons in his book, Dying of Money, you know, we're now in the good part of inflation, the early cycle of inflation. Everyone loves it, booming markets. What are you going to be watching when it comes to the later part of the cycle?
Couple things. We're going to watch how this tax bill unfolds because depending on what your income is, for example, if you make $1 million a year, you're no longer going to get favorable capital gains treatment or favorable dividend treatment. So if that goes into effect, the tax bill, if passed, is supposed to go into effect in 2022. So if you're Larry lots of bucks and you've got gains in the FANG stocks, Bitcoin, whatever it is, and you know you make over $1 million, that you're going to lose favorable capital gains treatment, I would suspect a lot of those people are going to start dumping stocks as we get closer to the end of the year. We might see distribution. So we're watching the tax bill, how that shapes up. because obviously if you raise corporate tax rates 40%, that means next year in 2022, you're going to see a drop in corporate taxes. Goldman Sachs and Bloomberg saying that this tax increase could cut corporate earnings anywhere from 8 to 10%. So obviously if rates start going down, just like in, for example, 2018, we saw the stock market go up 30%. It wasn't that corporate earnings were going up because of, let's say, a growing economy. It was because they cut the tax rates from 35 to 21. Well, there's got to be some kind of reaction to lower profits going into next year. So we're watching the tax bill. Then we're watching the LEIs to see if they have a turn. I don't think we're going to see that this year. I think this economy is going to boom. So that may be something for 2022. We're also watching the inflation gauges and interest rates. At some point, and as Ralph talked about, if we're looking at the 10-year Treasury note, which is roughly about 1.7%, there are some people saying, oh, if it crosses over 2, we could be in trouble. But, you know, folks, before COVID, we were talking about a 10-year Treasury note that was at 2.4%. So I don't see that as a threat to this market at this point. Even if we get to 2.5, that's still some of the lowest interest rates we've had in 5,000 years of recorded history. So we're watching the inflation gauges, the interest rate gauges. We're watching how this tax bill shapes up when it's finally passed. And then probably a story for 2022, we'll be watching the LEIs to see the impact. And if inflation continues to rise, as it is doing now and being underreported, at what point did the bond vigilantes show up? Because that's the thing that could change the whole equation.
So we're watching the LEIs, inflation, and taxes. And as you said, you know, this is going to be key when we're thinking about 2022, perhaps 2023. What about a little bit further out? What's the end game in your mind?
You know, at some point, we are now adding $4 to $5 trillion a year to the national debt. So 2 more years, we'll be at $40 trillion in debt. And 2 years after that, if we continue the stimulus, we're going to be at $50 trillion. At some point, Chris, these debt levels are unsustainable. I mean, the normal deficits just of running the government because of entitlements, interest on the debt, military spending. We were running $1 trillion deficits under Obama. We were running $1 trillion deficits under Trump. And that was in good times. So now the budget deficit last year in September was $3.1 trillion. And remember, it would have been higher because of the government's fiscal year ending in September. We actually had about 4 or 5 months of good economic growth before COVID hit. This year, the budget deficit is expected to be $4, $5, $6 trillion, depending on how many stimulus bills they put forward. So that is unsustainable. So eventually, what happens is the government is going to end up devaluing the currency. And as we said, it's my belief they're going to devalue it against gold. You can't devalue a currency against another currency because it's a beggar thy neighbor policy. You devalue, they devalue in response. So a devaluation against gold and a policy of financial repression. If the government can run inflation at 5, 6, 7% a year and keep interest rates down at 2% a year, you basically inflate the debt away over time. It's also, you hear a lot of this talk with the Fed, yield curve suppression. And that means going into the bond market and buying to drive down the yields, especially on the long end. So the Fed not only has to monetize the debt, but they also have to buy enough bonds to suppress the real interest rate on bonds. Because to inflate away the debt, that debt becomes worth less and less because it's inflated away. But in order to do that, you also have to keep interest rates because normally interest rates would rise with inflation. What the Fed's going to have to do is they're going to have to come in and counteract that and buy a lot more bonds. And so I just don't think that the Fed is going to be able to raise interest rates like they did. If you think about, they started raising rates in 2015. Normally, they wanted to get it up to 5%, which is normal. Let's say a Fed funds rate. That's what's been the Fed funds rate over several decades. They only got to 2.5, Chris. And we weren't even in a recession. They had to quickly reverse that going into 2019. So the end game, devaluation, financial suppression. And if you look at when this starts to hit the bad part, what you'll have, it'll start out with a market crash, a downturn, that leads to recession, depression, and then devaluation. And one of the big things that some scholars are now looking at is if you're spending $6 to $7 trillion a year to stimulate the economy now, when the economy is recovering, what do you do when you get in another recession? How big will the stimulus need to be to get out of the next recession or depression? So this is going to drag out much further. And, you know, this is probably an issue that we're going to be dealing with in 2022, 2023. We just simply don't know at what point, because a lot of inflation is psychological. It's you thinking, I don't want to keep my money in cash. I'm going to put it in the market. I'm going to go buy something tangible because money is losing its value. When that switch in inflation psychology kicks in, then it becomes non-stoppable. So that's another thing that we're going to be watching.
Well, the big picture for this week is, again, money for nothing. Checks are free. We're seeing modern monetary theory being implemented on steroids, as Jed Nardini said on our program this week. But let's take this down to the practical level, Jim. What are we doing here at Financial Sense Wealth Management with clients and in our portfolios?
Basically, it has been, Chris, a maximum tilt towards equities. We're in commodities, cyclical stocks in terms of rotation. We are more oriented to U.S. markets right now, but we think by the end, and the reason we are is the U.S. is rolling out its vaccines much more rapidly. So we're recovering faster than other parts, like, let's say, Europe or Asia. And so we are more oriented towards the U.S., but we think in the second half, that story changes and emphasizes international and emerging market, which is a second half story. We have minimum bond allocation, short duration. We've gone to convertible bonds simply because we're in an expanding equity market. We're looking at emerging market debt and, of course, base metals. I mean, you want to play green? Look at copper, look at lead, look at silver. You can't have solar panels without silver. You can't have electric cars and charging stations without copper. You can't have batteries without lead. So we're playing the Green New Deal with the raw materials that these EVs and a green economy is going to need. But right now, we're in a mega bull market, the good part of inflation. Enjoy the ride, because eventually it will come to an end.
That concludes our weekend edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. To speak with our financial planning and wealth advisory team, which has been servicing clients for over 35 years, feel free to give us a call at 888-486-3939. Also, don't forget to tell your friends and family about our podcast, Financial Sense News Hour, to stay on top of the latest developments in the market and how they impact your investments. Lastly, if you aren't already a subscriber and would like to listen to more of our premium content airing 3 days during the week through our website or through an app on your mobile device, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense News Hour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.